And the Academy Award for Best Podcast goes to Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. Except, wait, no, it doesn't. Oh, man.
Oh, guys, awkward.
Oh, no. WTF with Mark Maron. You guys won. No. This is not a joke. You guys get up here, man. Okay, while we sort out that debacle, I'll introduce the podcast. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a representative from Price Waterhouse.
Mike DiCrucio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I'm very excited for my promising career that just ended at Price Waterhouse.
as the law firm shuts its doors completely.
Yeah.
After all this.
Ruined it all.
Yeah. You had a good day there, though. A good one day at Price Waterhouse.
Yeah. Yeah, those 30 seconds were the best of my life.
There you go. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming today, and usually we talk about our movies or books or whatever we've been doing. Today, rather than discuss what we've recently seen or anything like that, we're going to be discussing the total insanity that was the 89th Annual Academy Awards. So that is very exciting. I'm very much looking forward to talking about that. And then after that, we'll move on to our featured review. This week, it is the newest film from director Jordan Peele, Get Out. Are you excited about Get Out, Mike?
Yeah. I think it's a promising debut from Jordan Peele.
Okay, spoilers, man.
I guess.
Save it for the review, bro. Although Get Out does currently hold a 99% of Rotten Tomatoes, which is pretty insane.
Yeah.
It actually held a 100 up until a couple days ago, when who else but Armin Dwight, the professional troll critic, was the first one to give it a negative review, which was pretty funny. I don't really care about the Rotten Tomatoes score that much. I just thought it was entertaining that, of course, Armin Dwight was the first guy to give it a negative review. Because it was at 100% for days, like past the opening weekend, like up until like Tuesday, I think.
Yeah.
Which is like unprecedented for the amount of reviews that movie had. So that was pretty cool to see. But of course, I'm always the one to blow that for everyone.
Naturally.
But anyway, before we get into Get Out, before we get into the Oscars, Mike, we have some other things to discuss today. Let's talk about some film news.
Hi. It's time for.
What?
It's time for.
All right, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast. And Mike, last time we met on a Film Bookcast for our John Wick 2 review, we discussed the fact that Matt Reeves was attached to be making The Batman.
Right.
Okay? Because Ben Affleck left the director's chair for The Batman, and there was a vacancy that needed to be filled. So Matt Reeves stepped up. He was the director of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Cloverfield, a lot of really great stuff. He's directing War for the Planet of the Apes, coming out this summer. I really like Matt Reeves. I think he's a really great choice for The Batman. But the thing is, after we recorded that episode, literally a day later, it turned out Matt Reeves was not directing The Batman. He dropped out of the talks. And so everybody was like, well, yeah, of course that happened, because Matt Reeves is a really talented guy, and DC is DC.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then about a week later, it turns out that Matt Reeves is in fact making The Batman again. So we don't even have to print a correction.
We were right all along.
So I did want to throw out that whirlwind of emotions that we had experienced there.
I just want to know how many dollars, like how many truckloads of dollars he's getting.
Yeah, you got to imagine something had to change. So it either had to be they gave him total creative control, which. Hopefully that's what it was.
We can hope for it.
Or they drove a dump truck of money to to Matt Reeves' house, and he couldn't say no. Hopefully it's the former. Hopefully it's both. I hope Matt Reeves makes a lot of money directing this Batman movie, and also he has complete creative control, like Christopher Nolan did for his Batman movies, you know?
That would be nice.
That would be cool. We'll see what happens. I'm not, you know, it's DC. It's... I find it so hard to get excited about whatever DC is doing these days. But here's another project that DC is doing, by the way. Chris McKay, who just directed the Lego Batman movie, which, as we talked about last time, I saw about an hour of before my theater cut out. And it was an enjoyable hour. I look forward to seeing the ending someday. Chris McKay, who directed the Lego Batman movie, is now attached to direct a live-action Nightwing movie for DC. And that is surprising. I guess.
Yeah.
At the same time, the Lego Batman movie is probably the most critically and commercially successful DC movie. Maybe not commercially successful, but certainly critically successful DC movie since The Dark Knight. Like.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting, too, that, you know, I mean, I haven't seen Lego Batman movie. From what I've heard, though, it has a very deep and well-rounded knowledge of the history of Batman and the Batman character. So it's interesting that, you know, they're going to use him to make a real one, quote unquote.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think you know, the Lego Batman movie is a lot of fun, and I'm hoping he can bring that sense of fun to a Nightwing movie. I feel like it's weird to have a Nightwing movie when we don't even have a Robin yet.
You know? Yeah, well, because if it's all based on Batman versus Superman and Man of Steel, like, Robin's already dead, right? Like,
yeah.
We see his suit with all the ha-ha-ha Joker stuff on it.
Right, right.
In Batman versus Superman. So, like, I guess it makes sense that we're going to get a Nightwing? I don't really know. I don't really know a whole lot about Nightwing other than that it's Robin.
I'm sure. I think what will end up happening, and again, I'm not sure if we'll ever see this Nightwing movie because it's DC. Apparently, DC has something like 17 movies in development right now.
That explains it all then.
Yeah. only a few of which we're guaranteed to see. You know, we're guaranteed to see Wonder Woman and Justice League. They're coming out this year. They're already being filmed. They're already
I hope we get to see them.
Imagine, like, this is like we're 4 months out from Wonder Woman. They just, like, pull it and we're like, nope. Just
cancel it. Yeah.
But yeah, so we're definitely going to see those, and we're almost definitely going to see Aquaman, which starts filming very soon. So those ones are pretty much locked in. But then I was reading an article about it, and there's like a rundown of all the DC movies that have been talked about. These are movies that have been confirmed to have some kind of development at some point in the last few years. The Flash, which has already lost two directors. The Batman, which lost Ben Affleck as director, now has Matt Reeves, but still has no script right now. Green Lantern Corps, which they just announced David S. Goyer is writing, who David S. Goyer co-wrote The Dark Knight Rises and co-wrote Man of Steel and all that stuff. Cyborg, which, sure, yeah, we're going to see a Cyborg movie.
At that point, yeah.
That was a sarcasm. I don't think we'll ever see a Cyborg movie. I actually had heard a rumor that the Cyborg movie might be, like, folded into the Flash movie, like it would be a buddy cop thing between Flash and Cyborg, and that would be cool.
I would be down.
I would be into that. Suicide Squad 2. Which the most recent rumors surrounding that movie is that Mel Gibson might be directing Suicide Squad 2.
Fucking sure.
Yeah, you know what? Suicide Squad did make a lot of money, so it makes sense they would make a Suicide Squad 2. But it is critically reviled. Like, people hated that movie. And same with Batman versus Superman. They're still trucking along with this universe, so they're not giving up without a fight. But I don't know if Mel Gibson is the choice to bring out for Suicide Squad 2. I feel like it's bad for both of them. You know, it's bad for Suicide Squad and it's bad for Mel Gibson. Why would, you know, like, Mel Gibson just got accepted back into Hollywood, right? He got, he was nominated for several Oscars for Hacksaw Ridge. Hacksaw Ridge actually won a couple of Oscars this past week. And so I think it would be weird for him to, like, finally be accepted back into the Hollywood elite, only to direct a sequel to one of the most critically reviled movies of this past year.
I know. It'd be really weird if it happened, but I guess. Like,
But in addition to that, Gotham City Sirens is a thing with Suicide Squad director David Ayer currently attached to direct that. A Deadshot spinoff is supposed to be in the works. Man of Steel 2 is supposed to be in the works. The Nightwing movie, directed by Chris McKay. A Shazam movie at some point with The Rock as Black Adam. And also a Black Adam movie with The Rock as Black Adam.
Right.
Justice League Dark, directed by Doug Liman. Lobo, which... I barely even know what Lobo is, but the picture here is very scary. And finally, Justice League 2, which supposedly would be by Zack Snyder, and originally that was going to be in 2019, but because I think of the critical backlash of Batman vs. Superman, now he's just doing the one Justice League movie instead of Justice League 2. So we'll see what happens with that. Who knows what's going on? But the point is, DC is just kind of throwing everything at the wall.
Yeah.
trying to see what sticks. And so... Chris McKay doing Nightwing after Lego Batman? Like, sure. Why not? Why not? I doubt there are 17 of these movies. I doubt we're going to see even 5 of those.
Right.
Quite frankly.
I know. It's kind of sad. Like, I would love there to be a bright, vibrant DC film universe. That would be really fun, I think.
I find it kind of funny, and I find it kind of sad that the dreams in which they're dying are the best they've ever had.
Yeah. Yeah, but they keep just trying to that wished me.
Really? Oh man, that's a good reference.
Sorry to let you down. It's kind of sad and frustrating that they keep trying to make the same four properties over and over again, like Superman, Batman, and like Green Lantern. I guess they just keep trying to.
if they end up doing this Green Lantern movie, that would be the second time. Yeah.
Yeah, but they have just as long a history as Marvel does. like of comic wealth to mine, like move off the
same. They have a longer history to mine. Yeah. They're making movies for longer too. Like the Superman came out in 78, you know?
Right. Yeah. it'd be cool to see them just move off of this, like the same three properties.
It would be nice. It would be cool. And hopefully if Justice League is good, that can allow them to branch off into other things.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens. I don't hold that much hope for the DC universe right now. But anyway, let's get off DC for a little while. I feel like every couple of weeks we just set aside some time to bash DC. And that's not totally fair, but at the same time, it's kind of justified.
Because we need to resist, Mike. Exactly. We need to resist the Snyderverse.
Exactly. Resist the Snyderverse at all costs. But here's something that I think is really interesting. So Martin Scorsese recently just came out with his movie Silence, which came out to theaters. And it didn't do very well at theaters. And it didn't do very well at the Oscars either. It got like one nomination for cinematography. But it just came out in the theaters, and it was a really interesting movie, really cool. And it's a Martin Scorsese movie, so you know it's just so incredible to look at. And, yeah. You know, it's just an experience. Every time Martin Scorsese comes out with a movie, it's an experience. And it's always a treat to go to the theater to go see a new Martin Scorsese movie. But now Netflix has picked up Martin Scorsese's next movie, and it's going to be a Netflix original. And so most likely it's going to just premiere on Netflix, on your streaming service. A Martin Scorsese movie. Starring Robert De Niro, mind you.
Yeah.
The long-awaited reunion between Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro, which is called The Irishman, which has been in the works since 2010. I've been reading about this movie forever. Has been picked up by Netflix to be released in 2019. That is insane.
That's crazy.
That is... I feel like that represents such a shift in the film movement. Like that's going to be a major factor in more and more movies going to streaming services and stuff like that. Like that is just an incredible get for Netflix, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's that we kind of talk about it pretty often. The rise of Netflix in terms and streaming services premiering things.
Dude, Amazon produced Manchester by the Sea, which was nominated for a bunch of Oscars.
Like, that's crazy. We also saw, I think during the Oscars, there was a trailer for a Will Smith superhero cop movie or something like that.
Directed by David Ayer.
Premiering on Netflix.
Yeah, called Bright. And actually, this year, I think, is going to be a breakout year for Netflix original movies. Because I was looking at the stuff that kind of coming up this year, and it's insane. They have new movies from David Ayer, that Will Smith movie. Which it's insane that Will Smith is starring in one of these movies, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Adam Wingard has a movie coming out on Netflix, Death Note. It's an adaptation of Death Note. David Wayne has a new movie coming out on Netflix this year. Duncan Jones, his Mute, is coming out this year. Bong Joon-ho, the director of Snowpiercer, has a new movie coming out this year on Netflix. All of those are coming out this year. Plus, there's a whole bunch of others, like The Discovery, which is the new film from Charlie McDowell, who's the director of The One I Love. That's going straight to Netflix. And yeah, there's Bright, which just aired a commercial during the Oscars. Like, there's so much original content, really promising original movies coming to Netflix this year. There's a lot of great talent coming in, and I know you just watched "I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore," which is a movie that just premiered on Netflix. It was considered a Netflix original. That movie played at Sundance and it won the grand jury prize there.
Right. And then got picked up and put on Netflix. That's crazy.
It is bonkers. So the fact that The Irishman has come to Netflix just seems like the final nail in the coffin for. The theaters anyway. Like I think the theaters will still exist for like major blockbuster movies and stuff, but I think a lot of the more interesting like smaller scale movies and a lot of like really talented people are going to these streaming services, which is pretty interesting, I gotta say. So and I will be interested to see how Netflix does with The Irishman, because I feel like that's a movie they will want to push for Oscars. So they'll have to change their release somewhat, because the Oscars have a very strict rule that it has to play in theaters for at least a week in L.A. or something like that. Like it has to have an Oscar-qualifying theatrical run, which is what they did. I remember a couple years ago, Netflix had Beasts of No Nation, the Cary Fukunaga movie with Idris Elba, and they were trying to position that to get nominated for a bunch of Oscars, and it didn't really. I don't think it got nominated for any, but they might have gotten nominated for like one or two.
I feel like it was nominated for something. I can't remember.
Maybe. I remember the kid from Beasts of No Nation was at the Oscars.
Yeah.
Presenting an award or something. I think he was hanging out with the kid from Room.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually.
Because if there's two kids at the Oscars, they got to hang out together.
They must know each other.
Don't all children know each other?
I think so, yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So that is insane, though. I was kind of blown away by that, that Martin Scorsese, who, by the way, is a huge proponent of... shooting on film and doing things on film, and he's recently kind of come around to digital. I know he shot I think Hugo on digital, I want to say. Yeah, because he did the Hugo in 3D. Right. And since then, he's been shooting his movies on digital. But he was like one of the longest holdouts for like serious like film projection and theatrical projection and all that stuff. So it's crazy to me that he is making a movie that's going to premiere on Netflix. But that is totally insane and totally wild. And I'm very excited for The Irishman, because that's a movie with that Scorsese and De Niro haven't made a movie together since 1995. With Casino.
I don't think I realized that. Yeah. That's crazy.
So that's bonkers. And it's also going to star apparently Al Pacino and Joe Pesci.
oh my god!
So it's like the Scorsese, it's like the Mafia All Stars in one. Yeah, you know. So that's pretty exciting. I'm super stoked for that. And yeah, so man, Netflix powerhouse, man.
They're doing big things.
Yeah, they've already been like the premier place for like a lot of TV shows.
Yeah,
they've become the premier place for stand up comedy too. A lot of major comedians are premiering their specials on Netflix. Michael Bigley just came out with one this week. Amy Schumer has one coming out in a couple of weeks straight on Netflix, and a lot of cool stuff. So, and now I think they're really jumping into the original movies game in a big way.
Yeah, I think we make the joke all the time that if you can't find a Netflix original thing for you, you're messing up, because they have 1,000 released every day.
yeah, at least one of them's going to hit. I have no idea how they're spending all this money. You know, we were talking about this. And I actually calculated how much money it would probably like.
You did the math?
I did a little bit of the math. I don't have the exact numbers with me right now. But if you think about it, there are about 300 million people in the U.S., right? Like give or take.
Right.
And everybody in let's assume that everybody in the country pays $10 a month for Netflix, right? Which is not an unfair assumption. So that's like $3 billion a month for Netflix right there.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, like, I'm sure that like you got to – there's so many other costs and stuff like to keeping Netflix going. You got to pay for bandwidth. Yeah. You got to pay for all these different things. But they are paying so much money for so many different movies and TV shows and stuff. I remember like The Get Down, this show directed by Baz Luhrmann, which came out this past year. It's supposed to be insane. I haven't watched the show, but I know it costs like $150 million. To make that, I think it was like a 6-episode show.
Wow!
I believe they paid like $200 million for The Irishman.
Jesus!
So that is bonkers.
I feel like I remember hearing they're operating at a loss, but I don't remember if that like I might just be making that up.
I
wouldn't be surprised.
They almost definitely have to be operating at a loss, but if that's the case, then how long can they do this for? You know,
I don't know. Yeah.
Either they like. Stop spending so much money on so much stuff, or they raise Netflix prices, and I don't think anybody wants that. So,
no.
You know, we'll see what happens. But as of right now, Netflix is doing some pretty incredible things for that kind of stuff. So that's very exciting. And then I do have one final bit of film news, which is not as exciting and much more sad, actually. Actor Bill Paxton passed away this past week at the age of, I think, 60-something.
61?
61.
That sounds
familiar. Yeah, and so Bill Paxton's a guy, he was in so much stuff. Like I feel like nobody thought that much about Bill Paxton as an actor, you know, because he was just always kind of like a supporting role in most movies that he was in. But he was great. Like he was so much fun to watch in movies and stuff. Like I mean, just look, like he's the only guy to be killed on screen by a Terminator, a Predator, and a Xenomorph. Like that.
Right.
Like that is an interesting statistic right there. That is a great.
That's a pretty crowning achievement.
Exactly. That's the triple crown. He's the only person. So that's really cool. But then, like in addition to all those, I mean, True Lies, Twister, Edge of Tomorrow, A Simple Plan, Titanic. He's in Nightcrawler. Like he's just in so much stuff. He was a big collaborator of James Cameron. I remember he was on the first season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He had a recurring role on that show. And he made the show better by him being like he was great on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Like the show was not that great, but he was great on the show, and he made the show better for the time that he was on it. So that was
there are apparently rumors that they were going to bring his character back for the next season.
Yeah, I don't know how they would have done that, because his character died at the end of the first season.
Oh, then maybe not then.
I actually heard. I think there was a rumor that they were gonna. I'm a couple episodes behind Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but I think they're doing a thing where they're bringing back dead characters, like as a
just Marvel things.
Just Marvel things, yeah. But I think I had read that there wasn't any plans for him to be on the show again.
Oh, okay.
But whatever. Do you have a favorite Bill Paxton performance, Mike? That you wanted to mention?
Well, I think I've talked about before that there are some movies that are foundational in my childhood, such as Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park.
Sure.
And one of those other, the other movie is Twister. It's another movie that I would watch all the time with my friends, like we were, or my babysitter. You know, we would always watch those three movies.
Yeah.
And Twister's not a very great movie, but it's a lot of fun, especially when you're a little kid. So that's like a foundational movie for me. But I think my overall favorite Bill Paxton performance is Frailty.
Okay. I've never seen Frailty, but I heard a lot of people talking about it in the past couple days.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty, I think it's a lesser known film from him. It's Bill Paxton and Matthew McConaughey, and it's creepy as fuck. Like, it's so good. It's super creepy. It has a great twist. So yeah, I think that's probably my favorite movie by him, other than Twister.
Yeah.
Which I think gave me my love of disaster movies. Just big, cheesy, silly disaster movies.
Yeah, I believe he directed Frailty also, Bill Paxton.
Really?
I believe so. I'm not 100% on that.
That sounds right.
I'm pretty sure he did. But actually, in regards to Twister, there was a thing, like the Weather Service representatives of America did like a tribute to Bill Paxton where they had like people all across the nation kind of putting in their GPS signals. And so it was in the shape of a big B and P.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I did see that online.
So that was pretty cool. My favorite Bill Paxton, I mean, I was actually just watching True Lies a couple of weeks ago as part of the as part of the Schwarzenegger marathon. And he is phenomenal in that movie as like this weird, like comic relief, like super pathetic character. But I really love him in A Simple Plan, which is a Sam Raimi movie from 98, which is like Sam Raimi's answer to Fargo. And it is a really, really strong movie. I highly recommend people check that out because I feel like that's kind of overlooked in Sam Raimi's filmography. And Bill Paxton is the lead role in that. He's really, really great. But I got to say, my favorite Bill Paxton performance is probably Aliens, where he plays Hudson in that movie. And he is incredible. He coined the phrase game over, man. Like that was him. That was all. That was an improvised line, too.
Really?
So that is that's a legacy right there, because I quote game over, man, constantly. Like, that's
all the time.
You've never heard me not quote game over, man. But yeah, so anyway, that was very upsetting to hear. And actually, during the Oscars this past week, there was a commercial that kept airing. It was like a Rolex commercial, but it kept using clips from different movies. And one of the clips was from Titanic, and it showed Bill Paxton wearing one of the Rolex watches.
Right.
And this was like the day after he died. So it was like super weird. Like, whoa, hey, Bill Paxton.
Yeah. Super awkward.
Yeah, and then they did mention him at the Oscars too. Jennifer Aniston mentioned him right before they introduced the in memoriam segment because they didn't have time to add him into the actual reel since it had just happened the day before. So Jennifer Aniston gave like a sort of tribute to him right beforehand, which was nice to see. But anyway, so RIP Bill Paxton. That was really upsetting. For sure. Hopefully, 2017 doesn't take as many of our favorite artists is 2016, but that is the way it goes.
You know? It's only February. We got a lot of time left.
That's true. Anyway, Mike, should we move on to our discussions?
We shall.
All right, let's move on to our discussions. Well, we're going to talk about the 89th Oscars. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my body and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions. All right, it's time for our discussions on Film Bookcast. And usually we use this time to talk about whatever stuff we've been watching lately, but this time we're just talking about the Oscars, the 89th Annual Academy Awards, hosted by Jimmy Kimmel, one of the most insane Academy Awards, I gotta say. Well, let's backtrack a little bit. It was a relatively fine Oscars for about 3 hours or so. Right?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, I mean, before all the craziness at the end, like what was your kind of overall take on the Oscars? This
is good enough, I guess, was kind of my feel.
Yeah.
I guess every year we're going to have food brought out now, which is fine. Like, that's funny, I guess. I, for one, enjoyed the tour bus bit. I thought that was silly. Like, why not, I guess.
I kind of liked it at first, but it felt like it went on forever.
It did take forever, yeah. And apparently they didn't, like, vet any of the people, and one of them is, like, a convicted rapist, which is, like, fucked up. So that's unfortunate.
It definitely is.
But other than that, it's okay. Like, sure, it was fine. I'll enjoy the Jimmy Kimmel, Matt Damon beef for another 10 years, I guess. Like, why not? Like, why not still have that going on?
Yeah. I thought it was a solid Oscar. You know, last year with Chris Rock hosting it, like, the Oscars felt more alive than usual, I guess. Like, it felt like a more vital thing. Anyway, Chris Rock was, like, killed it at the Oscars last year. He was incredible. And Jimmy Kimmel is a guy who I don't really like that much. I don't really watch his show, and I'm not the biggest fan of his, but, like, he can be funny. I think he was, like, pretty solidly funny here.
Yeah.
So, you know, the show as it went on, you know, it was solid. I thought most of the winners were pretty good. And not that I really care about who wins and who loses this kind of stuff, but, like, it is nice to see things that I like win things, I guess, you know. And so, you know, there's some good speeches and all that kind of good stuff. But really what everyone is talking about at the Oscars is the very, very end, which has been dubbed hashtag envelope gate, I believe is a...
Oh, my God. I hate it.
This has got to be the most insane Oscars moment, certainly in my lifetime. And one of the most insane things I've ever seen happen on live TV. You know, this was like seeing the Janet Jackson Super Bowl halftime show, but with less boobs.
But with significantly less boobs.
What happened here? I mean, we haven't really discussed what happened. You know, Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway were on stage. They were presenting Best Picture for the Oscars, the very last award of the night, and the awards had gone on for so long at this point. Like, they were it had run so late. It was supposed to end at 11:30. It was now 12:15.
Wow.
And so I was tired. You know, I had to wake up at work at 4 o'clock the next day. And so I was like, dude, we gotta keep this moving. We gotta go.
Come on.
And so Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway were presented the award, they announced the nominees, and then Warren Beatty opened the envelope, and you can see him look down at the envelope and kind of, like, act very confused. And I thought he was doing a bit, you know?
Yeah, it definitely seemed like a bit.
It seemed like he was doing a bit, and, like, Faye Dunaway thought he was doing a bit, too, and so he kind of, like, showed the envelope to her, and she read it and said, La La Land, which announcing La La Land as the winner for Best Picture. And so everybody from La La Land got up on stage, you know, everybody's, like, doing the celebratory thing, and then, like, halfway through that speech, you know,
the third guy was giving a speech.
Yeah. I think it was the second guy giving a speech. There were three guys. The second guy was giving a speech. And, like, halfway through that speech.
Oh, I see.
You know, Jimmy Kimmel and Warren Beatty came back out on stage. And, like, a couple other people were there, too. And it was, like, this whole big kerfuffle. They were in the background, like, behind the guy talking. And everybody's like, wait, what's going on? And, like, people were, like, freaking out. This third guy... this third La La Land producer started giving his speech after all this is going on, and he definitely knew something was up, and like he was giving his speech, but I guess his thought process was like, well, I'm up here, I might as well give my speech.
Might as well do it.
And then at the very end of his speech, he was like, well, we lost, by the way. That was a very confusing sentence, like, to hear. And then Jordan Horowitz, one of the other producers of La La Land, like kind of just swooped right out and been like, listen, guys, Moonlight, you guys won. There was a mix-up. Moonlight actually won this award, and then he like snatched the envelope out of Warren Beatty's hand and held it up, held it up to the screen, and it showed Moonlight had actually won Best Picture, and so everybody was like freaking out. Man, I was freaking out. Like I was only barely paying attention at first. You know, you know, La La Land won, and I had expected it to win, so everybody was like, you know, La La Land was the odds-on favorite, whatever. People were like, they were giving their speech. I was on Twitter. You know, kind of being like, well, you know, La La Land was my favorite movie of the year, so, you know, it's very rare for the Academy to coincide with my opinion, so, like, I'll take this as a win. Like, it would have been cool to see Moonlight get it, but whatever. And then, like, as soon as I sent that tweet, like, that's when Jordan Horowitz went over, it's like, Moonlight, you guys won, and I looked up, like, wait, what? Like, what? What did I miss? And so that was insane. So Warren Beatty kind of came back up to the mic and said, I want to explain what happened. I read the card, and the card said Emma Stone, La La Land. And so I was confused because Emma Stone can't win Best Picture.
Right, yeah.
And so he handed it off to Faye Dunaway, who I guess Faye Dunaway just saw the words La La Land and went with
right.
it. And so basically Moonlight went up on stage, did their thing. La La Land guys got off. I thought the thing was handled for as horrible a situation as that probably was for everybody involved, I thought it was handled pretty effectively. For the people who were on stage. I think the people backstage did not handle it effectively at all. Because they shouldn't have even, like, let the guys from La La Land get up on stage. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I think I was reading about this, that no one actually knows the contents of the envelope until they're opened on stage.
Right.
So they announced La La Land, and they must have opened the backup cards and realized that they had given him the wrong one, because they didn't. They must have not known Moonlight won.
Here's what happened. They did know, because there are there are two people from Pricewaterhouse who do know who wins.
I see. Okay, they actually know what's in the envelope.
They actually know what's in the envelope. Like, everything else is in total secrecy. So the people, like the people who know what's in the envelope, are the two Pricewaterhouse people who are on each side of the stage, giving the envelopes to people. Right. And they in past years they have had so much security around this. They've they take separate limos to go to this thing, so then so that if one of them gets stuck in LA traffic, the other one can make it and be okay, and all that kind of stuff. And every year they didn't do it this year, but almost every year on the show they bring out the guys from Pricewaterhouse and be like, yo, we just want to thank these guys. You know, they look after everything we do. And this year they didn't do it, so maybe it was a revenge thing. It probably wasn't. Apparently what happened is the guy from Pricewaterhouse might have been a little too busy tweeting backstage, Instagramming pictures of celebrities he's seeing backstage, and failed to notice that he had given the wrong card to Warren Beatty. But once they had read La La Land as the winner, those two back there who knew it was Moonlight should have done something immediately, right?
Yeah.
They should have ran out on stage and done something, just being no.
Yeah.
So that was bad.
It's super awkward, because if you watch the video again of Warren Beatty doing what we thought was a bit, you can clearly see now, knowing that he's confused, you can see, he looks off stage. Yeah, as he's showing Faye Dunaway, he's looking to the side, looking for some guidance, and then Faye Dunaway throws him under the bus.
Yeah, he's desperately seeking help.
Yeah.
And then the thing that confused a lot of people is that they had the best actress card, the envelope for best actress in leading role, which said Emma Stone, La La Land. But right after the show, Emma Stone said, "Yeah, I was holding on to my best actress envelope, so I don't know what they were telling you because I have it."
Yeah.
And so everybody was freaking out and reanalyzing the tape and trying to figure out what went wrong. Like it was the Kennedy assassination or something.
For real.
The envelope ricocheted off Warren Beatty and stopped in midair, mind you. Back and to the left. Gentlemen, I believe there is a second envelope.
Oh my God.
That we haven't accounted for.
That's such a long walk for that joke. That's amazing.
Which was great. And so apparently they do have two sets of envelopes on either side of the stage. And so it depends on whatever side the presenter is coming out on with the envelope. They can just hand it to the presenter on whatever side of the stage they need to be on. And when they do that, they're supposed to discard the envelope on the other side. They did not do that this time. So he has the best actress instead of best picture, causing this whole insane thing. It was so insane to see, and I felt bad for you, because you were watching the Oscars, you watched the whole thing, and then you turned off the TV as soon as La La Land won.
La La Land won. The first producer gets up and he gives a speech about how we need to support diversity in film on a stage full of white people, and I was like, you know what, I think I'm done, and I shut it off to go to sleep, and I get on Twitter 5 minutes later, and everything exploded.
Yeah, but you saw. I guess you watched it afterwards, right? You saw the.
I went back and was able to find it. Finally, watched the whole clip, and I must have shut it off. I think 5 seconds before it all happened.
that is insane. So yeah, that was such an insane thing to witness, and I don't know how the Oscars are going to be next year. I feel like they have to open with a joke about this.
Oh, absolutely,
almost definitely.
They should have Steve Harvey host. We need to – I think we do need to mention, or at least talk about, that this is the most tragic of all turns of events, because now the story in Oscar history is that they announced the wrong winner, and not that the first all-black cast in a movie about LGBT people won Best Picture.
Right. I do think that's incredibly significant. But at the same time, I think it actually might – help Moonlight in the long run, because this is a movie that if it had won in the normal way, people would be like, oh cool, Moonlight. But when things win an Oscar in the normal way, people forget about what won,
a few months later. I think you're right though that it will at least make it memorable that Moonlight won, but I think it becomes the story rather than the fact that it won.
Right, but I think what this is going to do is it will make more people see Moonlight than would have seen it otherwise.
I see. Okay, yeah.
In that respect, I think that's significant. And it might also make more people see La La Land than might have seen it otherwise, too. So, sure. I think both films are great. Like, I preferred La La Land, but Moonlight is awesome, too, and I think well-deserving of the award, and I think probably a better choice for this time period right now.
I did see this morning online that a UK movie theater played Moonlight instead of La La Land at a La La Land screening time. they trolled their audience.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
that is really funny. But yeah, and I think it also will be better for La La Land in the long run, too. You know, it won't be saddled with the fact that it won Best Picture. I feel like when something wins Best Picture, there's an immediate backlash towards that movie. And we have been seeing a backlash towards La La Land for the past few months as it was like almost a lock for Best Picture. And I feel like the backlash for La La Land was a lot more vitriolic to that movie than it has been for movies in the past. And I can't really understand why. I feel like it's a very charming and very, very nice movie. It's just a very nice movie.
Think that's why.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But it was like
we're living in the Snyderverse, Mike. Nothing's allowed to be just nice.
but I love La La Land. It was my favorite movie of the year, and so I would have been totally fine with it winning Best Picture. But I think Moonlight is a better choice for the time period that we're in right now. But it, like, what's crazy? But it was also kind of crazy about this. This was literally the plot of an episode of BoJack Horseman. Where Mr. Peanut Butter is supposed to announce the nominees for the Oscars, but loses all of them before he's supposed to announce them, and so has to make up new nominees.
Yes, that's amazing.
and so I think that's pretty great. Life imitates art in that way. But otherwise, I mean, yeah, so the actual show before all of this craziness went down, solid. You know, I thought Jimmy Kimmel did an okay job. He had some funny bits. I'm a big fan of Bashing We Bought a Zoo. I think that's a great...
That was great, yeah.
That is great. You know, it wasn't the best Oscars ever. It definitely ran way over time. Didn't have the urgency of Chris Rock, but it was solid. And I think, you know, Moonlight winning Best Picture, it also won Best Supporting Actor for Mahershala Ali, and Best Adapted Screenplay, which, so it's three Oscars, which is very good. And La La Land won 6 out of its 14 nominations, which is not as big of a sweep as I had expected. But definitely nothing to sneeze at. Like, 6 Oscars is quite good.
Yeah, I think that's still a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I believe that's the amount of Oscars that Mad Max won last year, actually. So... So
what a crazy sentence.
La La Land and Mad Max equals in the Academy's eye.
Yeah.
But yeah, it actually won Best Director for Damien Chazelle, which is why I thought it would go on to win Best Picture.
Right.
But at the same time, going into this, I thought there would be a split between Best Picture and Best Director. But I thought the split would be La La Land for Picture and Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight, for Best Director. Right. And it turned out to be the other way around. But not,
look at that.
But not at first. but Chazelle won Best Director, Emma Stone won Best Actress, it won Best Original Score and Best Original Song, of course, for City of Stars, by the way, which is the worst song in La La Land, Best Production Design and Best Cinematography, so very cool. And Manchester by the Sea, it won Best Original Screenplay and Best Actor for Casey Affleck. Hacksaw Ridge took 2 awards, Best Sound Mixing and Best Film Editing, both of which I thought La La Land was a lock for.
Right.
So that was a surprise kind of early on in the show. In sound mixing, I saw somebody say that sound mixing tends to go to the loudest movie that is nominated in that category. And I think Hacksaw Ridge definitely supports that theory.
Yeah.
And then for film editing, though, is interesting because that's often an indicator of something that will go on to win Best Picture. And so when Hacksaw Ridge won film editing, I was like, oh man, La La Land lost. Like, that's crazy.
What?
Is Hacksaw Ridge going to win this? Can you
imagine how mad everyone would have been?
Yeah. Can you imagine if the whole thing with La La Land and Moonlight like went down, and then right after Moonlight went up, Warren Beatty ran back out and was like, wait guys, wait, it was Hacksaw Ridge. Yeah. Actually, can you imagine if it was the other way around, if Moonlight had mistakenly won, and then La La Land was the actual winner,
there wouldn't be any more Oscars. Like, they would, like, that would be it.
They would torch the place. There would be riots in the streets. Oh man, it would be insane. It would be a lot worse if it was Moonlight and then Hacksaw Ridge won.
Oh man, okay, it's been an hour, Mike. We got to move on.
I still have so many things here, though, Mike. Viola Davis' speech I thought was very good. Like, that was a very effective speech, yeah. I thought. And Gail Garcia Bernal made a very impassioned statement against Donald Trump's wall while presenting the Animation Awards with Haley Steinfeld, which was a little out of place with what he was doing, but at the same time, like, I appreciate the sentiment.
That was still awesome.
Yeah. I would say the most, like, I feel like it wasn't as politically charged a night as I thought it would be.
I think that's just because it was Jimmy Kimmel.
I mean, there was definitely, like, Trump jokes and stuff like that, but you know, it wasn't as politically motivated as I thought it would be. I guess the most politically charged moment of the night was probably when Asghar Farhadi's film The Salesman won Best Foreign Language Film. Farhadi was that there. Anousheh Ansari, was there representing Farhadi, and accepted his award on his behalf and read a speech from Farhadi speaking out against Trump's immigration ban, which what made it difficult for Farhadi to show up in the first place. So there was that. And then there was just other odd things throughout the show. Suicide Squad and Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them both have Oscars now.
Yeah, like, sure.
So that was odd. I mean, Suicide Squad was, like, the egregious one, I thought. Like, that won Best Makeup, which, okay, it had characters with makeup on them.
Technically.
I get why it was nominated, sure. But, you know, that's – these, and they actually, like, the guys who won that award gave a really good speech, like, a really, like I don't remember exactly who it was, and I don't remember exactly what the content of the speech was, but I remember being, like, somewhat moved by their speech. But Suicide, like, it won an award for writing the word "damaged" on Jared Leto's forehead. Like, that's
right. Like, that's it.
That is it. So that's that was odd. But now we can say the Academy Award winning Suicide Squad,
right?
And not be wrong about it.
Yeah, you can have the Academy Award winning director Mel Gibson directing the Academy Award winning franchise Suicide Squad.
Man, what a world the Snyderverse has turned into.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And I also really like the thing where they paired a contemporary actor with someone they admire and pay tribute to one of their films. I thought that was a really cool thing to celebrate movies, which is what the Oscars is all about, really. So, like, they had Charlize Theron discussing Shirley MacLaine in The Apartment, Seth Rogen talking about Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future, which was pretty cool. And they opened,
which was the coolest bit.
And they had the DeLorean. Yeah, they sang Hamilton songs. It was great.
Yeah.
It was tailor-made specifically for me. I enjoyed that very much. And Javier Bardem talking about Meryl Streep and Bridges, Madison County. You know, this is cool stuff. And then they had the Capper joke with Jimmy Kimmel talking about Matt Damon, We Bought a Zoo, which was very funny. And then, but at the same time, what better way to kick off a celebration of film than with the song from Trolls?
Yeah.
Fresh out the gate, the Oscars opened with a performance from Justin Timberlake singing his Oscar-nominated song from Trolls. That was silly. I mean,
only for us to be trolled with the last award.
Boom. It began with Trolls and it ended with Trolls. Good job, Mike. Anyway, so I wasn't feeling the Justin Timberlake performance, really, but I really liked Alihia Carvalho singing How Far I'll Go from Moana.
Yeah,
I thought that was really cool. Complete with intro by The Rock and original rap prologue by Lin-Manuel Miranda. So obviously, again, tailor-made for me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I thought Sting and John Legend were both fine. Like, John Legend performed both of the La La Land songs that were nominated. You know, they were just, like, solid. You know, they were okay performances. I thought they were fine. Again, I do think the two La La Land songs that were nominated were not the best songs in that movie. You know, that's, like, I would say, you know, the opening song, Another Day of Sun, is probably the best one. But then there's, you know, the other song, Someone in the Crowd, I really like too. The ones that were nominated were City of Stars and Audition. Audition is great in the context of the movie, but I think it's kind of boring on its own. And also kind of sounds like Rainbow Connection, which is which is weird. Otherwise, last thing, the Independent Spirit Awards aired the night before, which were hosted by John Mulaney and Nick Kroll, and that was an award show, Mike. that was awesome. If you haven't seen their monologue yet, their monologue's online. It's like 10 minutes long. And it is incredible. It's so much better than whatever Jimmy Kimmel did at the Oscars this year. So that was cool. But anyway, yeah. So the Oscars, man.
They happened.
It was obvious. This is an Oscars I will remember forever. Like, this is like...
Yeah.
Like, I've been watching the Oscars every year since I was like 10 years old. I remember the first Oscars I ever watched was the year that Return of the King won every award.
Wow. Every award.
Well, they won 11 Oscars, Return of the King.
Yeah.
It was insane. I remember, like, there are Oscar moments that I remember throughout the years. Like, I remember Return of the King winning all the things. I remember Martin Scorsese winning his Oscar for the first, like, his very first Oscar for The Departed. And so far, still only Oscar, I believe. which is insane to me. This is joining those ranks. And I think it's in a different kind of joining of those ranks, because it's not actually about, like, an achievement of any kind. It's about this kind of massive screw up on the behalf of the producers of the show. But at the same time, that's what live TV is all about.
There you go.
So there you have it. Anyway, Mike, we should get into our featured review, right?
Yeah, it's only been an hour.
I believe you said that an hour ago. Let's get into our featured review of Get Out.
You got your toothbrush?
Check.
Do you have your deodorant?
Check.
Do you have your cozy clothes?
Got that.
What?
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
I ain't never seen you like this before, bro.
Meeting families and taking road trips. Don't come back all bougie, man.
Come back, get your damn pants up to your damn stomach.
So you guys coming up from the city?
Yeah, we're just heading up for the weekend.
Can I see your license, please?
He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Call me Dean and you're hungry, my man.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? We hired Georgina and Walter to help care for my parents. When they died, I couldn't bear to let them go.
Do you smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit.
She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
Are you ready for this?
I'm back in B.
So look, I go do my research. Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
But it's cool.
Bro, how you not scared of this, man?
Couldn't see no brother around here.
Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here. Get out.
Sorry, man.
Get out!
Yo!
All right, that was from the trailer for Get Out, the newest movie directed by Jordan Peele. It stars Daniel Kaluuya, Allison Williams, Bradley Whitford, Catherine Keener, Caleb Landry-Jones, Little Ray Howery, Betty Gabriel, Marcus Henderson, Lakeith Stanfield, and Stephen Root, among others. And you're going to love this IMDb plot synopsis, Mike.
I'm so excited.
In the history of vague IMDb plot synopsises, this is one of the best. One of the best ones.
Hit me.
A young African-American man visits his Caucasian girlfriend's mysterious family estate.
Yes. This is the best thing of all time.
That is it. That is the entirety of the IMDb plot synopsis. That is a thing of beauty right there.
Wow.
I am proud of IMDb for just taking the plot of this movie and condensing it to, well, like 10 words.
Yeah. That's ridiculous.
It is bonkers. Mike, so Get Out has quickly become one of the most acclaimed horror films in some time. As I mentioned before, up until a day ago, it held 100% of Rotten Tomatoes, which was basically unprecedented, and Armin Dwight gave the film its first negative review, because that's what he does, so it's at a 99 now. I remember Armin Dwight is a guy, I actually talked to him on Twitter once, because he was the one of the few people who gave a positive review to Ghost Rider 2. And I tweeted something like, of course, Armin White gave, I think he actually guest starred on the Slash Filmcast for their review of Ghost Rider 2.
Okay.
And I was listening to it and I was like, of course, and I tweeted about it. Like, of course, Armin White was the guy who like, is the one guy who gave a positive review of Ghost Rider 2. And then he tweeted at me. I did not tag him in Twitter or anything. He tweeted at me saying like, yeah, you should read about it too. And he like linked to his review of Ghost Rider 2.
Oh wow, he's so desperate. That's amazing.
And I was like, all right, man, I will. Like, jeez,
calm down.
And I remember there was actually one year in the year 2010. He and I had the same favorite movie of the year, which was Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And I was doubting myself so much because I was like, how can I have the same favorite movie as Armin Dwight?
There's no way.
There's no way this could be a thing. But anyway, so yeah, of course he was the one that first gave it a negative review. I hadn't actually heard about him in a long time. I thought he had like faded out of the public consciousness. So maybe he did this to gain some notoriety again. I don't know.
Probably.
But anyway, Jordan Peele directed this movie, Mike. And I don't think anybody expected Jordan Peele, who is known for the sketch comedy series Key and Peele, to foray into horror for his directorial debut.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Jordan Peele's on a most recent episode of the Nerdist podcast where he talks about his history as a film buff, and he tells the story that his parents would give him $20 a week for lunch for school.
Yeah,
and he said immediately he would go to the movie store or video store and blow it all and buy $20 worth of VHSs, and then have to like mooch off friends for lunch. So that, I mean, it's pretty interesting that's his you know, his history, I always just knew him as the comedian guy, right. You know?
Yeah. And Key and Peele, I mean, it's one of the most acclaimed sketch shows of the past several years. Like, it's one of the heavy hitters. And so it was definitely surprising, but it seems to have paid dividends for him, this horror, this foray into horror, because it's super critically acclaimed. And I think it was also a really big hit. And this is another one from Blumhouse, who was just fucking killing it this year.
I know.
between Get Out and Split, and they've got the Belko Experiment coming up, which might be another big hit too. We'll see. Plus, they've got Insidious 4 and a new Amityville coming out this year. So those might not be critical hits, but they will probably make money.
It's interesting to see that they're doing, you know, we always end up talking about them every time we review one of their movies, that they kind of do this thing of, you just have to make a movie for dirt cheap and you will get complete control of it. Go make your movie.
Yeah.
And it works. Fucking works.
It's really working out for them. That's very cool. And, Get Out has been classified as a horror comedy, but I think that's a little strong. I'd say it's horror first and comedy second. There is certainly some really funny moments in this movie, especially the ones that involve Little Ray Howery as Chris's friend Rod is his name. But I think Jordan Peele is more focused on getting the audience to feel as increasingly unsettled as Chris is, and I think it works out really well. I think he has like a really good you were saying before, he's a huge horror geek.
Yeah.
And I feel like he has like this immense knowledge to draw from. Like, he knows what to take from other horror movies, and knows like what will make the most suspenseful scene or scariest or creepiest scene that he can think of.
Right.
And so I think that's very cool. And you know, I don't know if Key or Peele had any say in the visual style of their show, because I know that show, I think every episode of that show was directed by Peter Atencio, who also directed them in Keanu, which is a very funny movie, by the way. I don't know if you ever saw that.
I haven't seen it yet. No.
You should give it a watch. It's really good. But the show always really kind of nailed it whenever it was trying to mimic filmmaking techniques. I remember there was this the spoof of 2012's Les Miserables that was just totally dead on. Like, it looked like Les Mis. And it was insane. So I think Peele has taken some lessons from his work there too and kind of applied them to this. And Get Out is surprisingly visually inventive, I think. Like, there's a lot of stuff in this movie that I thought, I was kind of surprised at what he was able to pull off, especially when Chris is in the sunken place.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's definitely those are definitely the most striking moments in the film to me visually. But yeah, he also talks about in that Nerdist episode that Stepford Wives is the biggest inspiration for this film, and is especially dealing with suburban horror. He looked to Halloween for influence.
Right.
So yeah, and he talks about using that. There's a segment where he's trying to convince Chris Hardwick, the host of Nerdist, to direct, because he has just a deep knowledge of the things that he loves, and that that gives you the opportunity to steal, quote unquote, you know,
right.
to pay homage,
yes.
to all those things. So that definitely shines through in Get Out.
Absolutely, yeah. And Chris is played by Daniel Kaluuya, who I knew from a couple. I guess I've seen in a couple other things, but what I really knew him for was the one Black Mirror episode that he was in, which I saw recently. He is the star of 15 Million Merits,
fucking
blew my brains out, that episode.
That's the realest episode.
Yeah, I just watched that a few months ago, and I haven't finished Black Mirror yet, because I was in such an emotional state after 15 Million Merits that I felt like I couldn't keep going. But that episode of TV is just incredible, and he's great in that show. Like, he is amazing in 15 Million Merits, and that blew my mind when it turned out this was him, because I didn't realize it until like maybe like a day or two before I saw the movie. Like, it was on Wikipedia. I was like, whoa. But yeah, and he's really good here too. You know, I think he has a very effective performance. You know, there's this awkwardness at the beginning that kind of gives way to suspicion later on, which gives way to terror. And I think he plays them all very well. Likewise, Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener are very good in the movie. They provide a lot of laughs early on. I feel like everybody kind of provides like laughter early on, and then like as the movie goes on, it gets a little more sinister. I especially like Bradley Whitford in this movie. I thought he was really good.
Yeah, everyone is able to portray this mounting tension that, like you said, starts off as goofy and like it's kind of this silly thing, the awkwardness of what the situation is, and then that slowly turns into, like you said, suspicion and then terror. And the ensemble in this movie is like insane for Jordan Peele's first movie. Like,
it actually is. Yes, I mean, he got Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener. Allison Williams plays Chris's girlfriend, Rose. And Allison Williams has never been in a movie before. This is her first one. She's been, I mean, she's been starring in Girls for the past several years. Do you watch Girls by any chance?
No, not really.
Okay, I watch Girls. I'm a big fan. And she's, like, I've always been a fan of Allison Williams from that show. I really like her on that show. So it was cool to see her in this movie and to actually be as good as she is. I actually think, like, she's good in the movie. She has one sequence towards the end in which I thought she was incredible. Like, it was bonk. And I'll talk about that scene in spoilers, but, like, it was just a really incredible performance in that one scene that I thought was great. And then the rest of the cast. I mean, Lakeith Stanfield's in this movie, who is on Atlanta right now. He's the guy who – he plays Logan, I think the guy's name is.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was very effective because he shows up at the beginning of the movie and then he shows up, like, midway through playing a very, like, different variation on his character. And I thought both were done very well. Like, he's basically playing his character from Atlanta at the beginning of the movie, which is pretty great. And, yeah, he was also in Straight Outta Compton. He played Snoop Dogg in that movie. And then there's Steven Root, which was cool to see, too.
Yeah.
As, like, this blind art dealer, which has a couple of jokes there in regards to that. But, yeah, and we haven't really talked about the fact that this is, like, a racially aware horror movie.
I was going to say, it's interesting that on one level, this is just – it's just a straight ahead horror film. But then, it operates on, so many deeper levels of what's going on.
Right.
And, the racial issue is at the forefront. And what's going on, but it's not the source of the horror, I don't think.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
It's kind of used as a backdrop, and I think there is one moment towards the end that really plays on your perception of racism really, really effectively. And I'll talk about that in spoilers too. It's mostly as like a backdrop, but this is like, Jordan Peele is a black man. He's probably experienced racism throughout his entire life. And so he's kind of taken what is a horror for many people and turned racism into a horror movie. And I think that's really effective. And like, it's also Jordan Peele. So I feel like it can't not be at least a little funny, and that's what they did on Key and Peele too. They used to make fun of racism and use it to like talk about other issues and stuff like that. And I think that's what Get Out does here too. And so that was very effective. But is there anything else, any kind of overall stuff you want to talk about before we get into spoilers, Mike?
No, I don't think I'll just say that I think it's I wasn't as afraid or scared as I thought I was going to be going into this film, just in terms of like as a horror movie, but that doesn't mean that it fails. Like it still is effective at what it does. I was still scared and experiencing suspense. Suspensed. That's not the right word.
I was suspensed. Yeah. I agree with you. Like I feel like I wasn't like terrified or anything.
Right.
And I'm not somebody who gets terrified at horror movies that easily. It's just 'cause I've seen so many of them. But at the same time, I feel like I was into it. Like it was effectively creepy like throughout.
Yeah.
Like it has this kind of like mounting tension thing, and like the way the movie plays out towards the end was stuff I didn't really expect. Like to that end, I was impressed, and there's a lot of stuff that I thought was just really effective, and especially the stuff in the sunken place, which we'll talk about in spoilers. But I guess we should do that. Let's get into spoilers for Get Out.
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it. Let's get into spoilers for Get Out, starting right now.
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! You're spoiling everything!
All right, spoilers for Get Out, starting right now. So I wanted to talk about Allison Williams' amazing scene in the movie, and this is after Chris has been like knocked out and kidnapped by the family, like he's tied to the chair and stuff. And Rod tries to call Alice, tries to call her phone. And so she, like, you just hear her voice on the other end of the line, and she's hitting on Rod. Like that's the thing that she's doing.
Yeah.
This is after she's already been revealed to be evil. Everybody in the family is evil. And actually, like, the fact that I had a suspicion that she would be evil from the beginning. I don't know. That just seemed like
seems like a way that could go.
Yeah. But the way that played out, like he's calling on the phone and he knew something was up because she was hitting on him and it was irregular. But the way she was doing it, like she was like hitting on him and she was like, there's so much emotion in her voice when she was like over the phone. Like you could there was a lot of concern for Chris and all that stuff. And then you see the other end of the line and she's just sitting there motionless. Like all dressed in white and like just sitting like this vacant expression on her face. But she's still talking and all the emotion and stuff that was over the phone is still coming out of her voice, but she's just like sitting completely still. And like, it's so eerie. And it's,
it was like some Terminator shit.
So I thought that was a really, effective acting moment from Allison Williams. That was like really incredible. Like I had chills, coming up that, but anyway, so as it turns out, the Armitage family, which is Allison Williams' family, Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener and Caleb Landry-Jones, have been kidnapping black people and lobotomizing them through hypnosis. That's lobotomizing, right? That's what it would be?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
To allow Bradley Whitford, who was established early on as a brain surgeon, to swap older white people's minds into their bodies. And that was a bonkers reveal.
Yeah, that's not where I thought this was going.
Not at all. But I think it really worked, because the movie kind of gives you a little more of what's going on throughout the movie. Like, you kind of get a hint at what's to come early on. I mean, it establishes early on that Bradley Whitford's a brain surgeon. Like, in passing dialogue, Alice Williams says that to Daniel Kaluuya. And then, you know, it'll just mention, you'll see a video of her grandparents, but they're not around, and you're like, what's going on there? And it turns out Georgina and Walter, the two black servants of their family, are actually Rose's grandparents, and not their servants. And was there a reason why they were serving as servants? Was that established?
Not exactly. We're told, we brought Georgina and, what was it, Walter? Is that what the guard?
Walter, yeah.
Yeah, Walter were brought in to help out with my grandparents, that's kind of it.
I figured those people were brought in to help out with the grandparents, but then they had their minds swapped with the grandparents.
Yeah.
But then why did the grandparents continue working as servants for the family?
It might be a keeping up appearances thing, because they were told that this party happens the same day every year, and all these things. And we are shown that Walter is opening the limo doors for all the guests arriving at the manor, and they're giving some pretty big bear hugs to this guy who's the gardener. They are shown familiarity and stuff like that. Everyone else knows is in on it other than Chris. So I think that was an interesting, you know, thinking back on after it's revealed that they're the grandparents, that they may have just been doing that for Chris.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, I could see that. But I gotta say, when Chris escapes from the family at the end, there is so much catharsis in watching Chris escape from the family, and there's some ingenuity there where he's picking the cotton out of the couch and he ends up plugging it into his ears to avoid the hypnosis that is sure to come. So I thought that was very effective, and you watch him knock out Caleb Landry-Jones, and you watch him kill Bradley Whitford, and you watch him kill Catherine Keener and kill Caleb Landry-Jones again. And this it's just so satisfying to see him kill all these white people.
But for real, man.
And the movie and what I thought was really effective, the movie plays on your knowledge of racism, of how black people tend to get treated by the police, to end in this incredible fist pump moment. When Rod shows up in his TSA car, and this is after Chris and I almost said Marnie, which is Allison Williams' character on Girls.
Rose.
When Chris and Rose and Walter are in the middle of the street, and Walter has just been woken up from his trance because the flash photography of the phone makes them kind of revert back to their original selves for a second, I guess. And so he shoots Rose and then shoots himself. And then Chris is lying there in the middle of the road. And then this police car shows up and you're like, oh no. Cause that looks real bad.
Yeah, it does.
But then it turned out to be Rod, and it's yes.
Yeah,
that was very effective.
Yeah, there's also, I think, this twist in some weird way. Like you said, it your expectation of racism and stuff, and it's explained when Chris is in the room when he's tied down in the chair and he's talking to Stephen Root through the intercom, and he asks Stephen Root why black people, why do you guys, and it's not. It's not racist. It's what he explains isn't.
Yeah.
He says that he in that case, he wants Chris's eyes because he's such a good photographer. Other guy wants to just be cool and quote unquote, black people are cool according in the movie. they want to be strong. It's really, I don't know. It's just a really interesting take on what that would be. I think it kind of subverts in some weird way of they're not kidnapping and just hypnotizing and turning them into slaves, which I think would be the unoriginal version of that story.
Sure. Yeah, that's true. That's what Rod thinks is happening,
right?
As well,
exactly.
But yeah, so and I did want to say that the flash of a camera phone seems like a pretty significant weakness for this procedure. I thought the scenes were effective when those happened. There's the scene early on, like when they first established that that happens with Lakeith Stanfield's character. And Lakeith Stanfield has like this kind of meltdown, and he's like shouting at him, "Get out, get out!" And I'm like, "Hey, that's the name of the movie.
that's where it's from."
You know, and then the, it comes into play later again when he does it to Walter. I thought those scenes were effective, but like flashes are super common. You know, it's I feel like that had to have been a problem before Chris showed up, right? Like,
well, I think it's the you know, kind of Stepford Wives thing that Jordan Peele talked about, where like the whole town is in on it,
right?
So and they don't leave the town ever, so it seems at least.
Yeah, I could see that, but like not like, you know, when there's an outsider and there's a flash, like you would think.
Yeah, that's true, I guess.
But I did think the freakouts were great, and it sets up Walter turning on Rose at the end, which is effective. And I mean, you were talking about Stephen Root before, and like how he kind of like justifies, like, "Well, I want your eyes because you're a great photographer." I think it's kind of interesting. Like, that's like he's saying it's not a racist thing, but obviously race has something to do with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're only doing it to black people. And so I feel like it's sort of a commentary on the way that white people will just make up ways to kind of justify racism.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That's absolutely.
And so I thought that was a really interesting point that the movie is trying to make. And I thought all the hypnosis stuff was just really well executed. You know, how when it first happens, when he's like sitting down with Catherine Keener, and she's kind of stirring the teacup, and like you don't really know what's going on yet. But and like he doesn't really realize what's going on, and like as soon like you and Chris kind of realize what's going on around the same time. But by then it's too late. Like he's already kind of like in the hypnosis like state.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was very effective. And like when he's in the sunken place, it just gets all black, like his entire like darkness surrounding him. And he's like falling and falling. And like, you see like, the actual like room that everybody else is in, like in the distance. And, I thought that was very, very cool. As a visual, I thought that was very effective.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a really interesting way to, depict being a spectator in your own mind or something, like as they describe it, that, you know, with the lobotomy, the part of the brain that's attached to the brainstem will still be there,
right,
as described in the film. So like there's still some consciousness of the original person left, and they're just gonna be sitting in the back there viewing it through a frame of their own eyes. I don't know, right. I feel like I sound like Jaden Smith. But I thought that was a very original and really like beautiful image, like of Chris falling in slow motion away from his own consciousness. I don't know. It was really cool.
I agree. And we haven't really talked about how funny this movie is, but there's a lot of very funny moments. You know, especially involving Rod. Like, I think he has a lot of the big laugh lines in the movie, but even then there's just like subtler stuff. I really liked the way Bradley Whitford played his character, like in the first half of the movie. You know, the way he, like, he was just casually bringing up, like, "Oh, but I would have voted for Obama for a third term if I could have."
Yeah, I do love that they do talk about, like, the casually racist stuff that white people do. Like, you're talking with a black guy, now all of a sudden you say "my man" all the time. which is at once hilarious and, two, horrifying to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and like Daniel Kaluuya plays it off kind of well as, like, you know, this is something he's uncomfortable with, but it's also something he's used to. Like, it's something that he's, like, familiar with happening to him.
Especially the scene when they hit the deer on the way there, and the cop asks for his ID, even though he wasn't driving.
Right.
And he's kind of just like, "Oh, whatever, like, here you go." And Rose stands up to the cop. Which, like, is that a plant? It seems like it probably is. Like, that's, you know?
You mean that's, like, a thing for him to, like, get him to trust Rose kind of thing? Like, that?
Yeah, it seems like it. Like, the way it turns out that everyone is in on this thing that happens.
I mean, I don't know if they could have, like, just... like, you think somebody just, like, threw a deer into the road?
That's not what I meant, no. That, like, the cop knows what's going on, is involved somehow. I don't know.
Perhaps, yeah. But I don't know if they could have...
perceive a deer hitting a deer.
Yeah.
No. Okay. Sure.
All right.
But I do also like that the film does touch on how racism is generational and passed down along family lines, and like it starts with the grandpa and the Bradley Whitford. Is he their son? I don't remember who's related to who exactly.
I believe Bradley Whitford was the grandpa's son.
Is the son? Yeah. And you know, his kids are involved, and it's like it passes all the way down the whole family tree, or that we're shown at least. So I don't know. I thought that was cool that they at least address that. Like, we talked about how white people have the insane ability to be able to justify things as not being racist in their own mind.
Right. All right. So this has been two white guys talking about Get Out.
Yeah. Such is life.
But anyway, I think we really enjoyed the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You know, very, very solid. And I think I'm really excited to see what Jordan Peele does next now. Like, I think he said something like he's got like 5 or 6 more socially conscious thrillers in the pipeline.
If they're all as good as this, I'm in.
Yeah, like, exactly. So that's pretty cool. But do you have any other last thoughts on Get Out, Mike, before we wrap this up?
No, I think I said my stuff.
Cool beans. Were you gonna say something? No.
No.
Okay. Right, I thought I heard you like say like what, as if you're gonna be like one more thing, but nope.
Hold on.
All right, Mike. Where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all my other stuff at filmbook.com and crookedscoreboard.com. I've been writing for there as well. Thank you for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike's Cree Show. If you are listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you are emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us next week when we will be discussing Hugh Jackman's final, last, done for sure this time, performance.
But maybe.
Performance as Wolverine in Logan. I am very excited about this movie, man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is, I think the, I don't know. I couldn't think of an actual term, but I'm super fucking pumped for this movie.
I mean, this is like I really think this is legit Hugh Jackman's last time. Like, this movie is designed to be Hugh Jackman's like last go as Wolverine. And it just looks awesome. Like, the reviews have been stellar out the gate, so I'm pretty excited about that. And like, he's been doing Wolverine 17 years now. Like, that's
bonkers. Crazy.
That's longer than like Roger Moore did James Bond, you know? Like, that is insane. So pretty excited for that. And then you can check out our next Complete Works, where we'll be entering the new millennium. And we've already entered the new millennium. We're going to keep going with the new millennium.
We're going back in time.
And talking Nicolas Cage's role in The Family Man. So that is something directed by Brett Ratner, who directed Hugh Jackman as Wolverine in X-Men The Last Stand.
Look at that.
Tying it back together. Thank you guys so much for listening. We are out.